Our topic, which was proposed by Alexander, is the Exodus versus the lynch mob. And I was thinking about Heidegger, and I was thinking about his notion of authenticity. And I was thinking about the authentic person as the guy, perhaps, who joins the Exodus. Am I getting that right, Alexander? Or
yeah, but especially we're looking at leadership. So in Digital Libido, John Sedekist and I identified the authentic phallus and the fake phallus. The fake phallus leads by arranging an abjection. So say you got Hitler and the Jew, you got Stalin and the Kulak, you got Pol Pot and anybody who wore glasses in Cambodia in the 1970s. So, or it could be just woke today has the white heterosexual man. So you find somebody you can hate and thereby, in theory, unify everybody else into some kind of a lynch mob, right? So that's how lynch mobs operate. That's the fake phallus. The authentic phallus, though, more difficult and much more rare in history, unfortunately, is the proper authentic leader. Now, if you look at, that's why we wanted to study the Exodus for the new book, not just the Exodus out of Egypt, but all the Exoduses, since we've been working with paradigm shifts our entire oeuvre. So all our books are about the current paradigm shift, essentially. That what does it mean to leave industrialism with capitalism and mass media and the life we sort of lived here and move into the new realm of the internet society or the internet age or the network society and digitalization. What does that mean? And of course, a whole new class structure will step forward. Some people are better at or more fortunate when it comes to having the resources that pay off in a new society. We identified that in the book called The Netocrats 20 years ago. So all our work has been about paradigm shifts. And a paradigm shift really is an exodus out of one age into a new age.
Yeah.
So we call this exodology. That's what we pursue in this book. A theory on exoduses. Why do they happen? Why do they tend to be so successful compared to the alternatives, which is, of course, are the lynch mobs? And why do you leave a certain territory, say the Egypt of the lynch mob, and you walk into the promised land of the Exodus? And what does that take? And of course, this ties into the authentic phallus, who of course leads the Exodus, a Moses, for example, and the fake phallus, who obviously leads the lynch mob. And I don't know if this is part of Girard's fantastic study on the lynch mob or not. When he talks about Satan, that is the tyrant to us. In our last episode, we talked about the
Satan's antigen. The tyrant and the mob, though, right? Satan is the spirit of the mob.
No, well, the spirit of the mob is the anoject. So yeah. What's important always is to find the precursor to the phenomenon you're going to study. So we can call all of this, paradigmatic embryonism. I suggested it to our dear friend Brady Elung the other day, and he loved it. So paradigmatic embryonism means you study who was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time before the paradigm started, or who saw it coming and could therefore prepare for it and was hungry enough to actually benefit from it. In other words, who's the Hebrew in Egypt when Moses comes along? Mm-hmm. Okay? So the anoject is clearly the lynch mob. It's this Heideggerian Das Mann. So it's clearly the, nobody actually says it, but it's assumed. Like
Das Mann is a Heideggerian word for inauthentic, is that?
Yeah, like one rather than you or I. So it's not somebody who speaks about themselves like, I believe, but rather one believes.
Oh, I see.
And when you say one believes, you're hiding behind something. You say one believes in the general sense, like, well, so, I just believe like everybody else because I'm a conformist and I'm scared of being the outsider of the group. And because I'm terrified of the lynch mob, I'm going to pretend I'm part of it. So I'm going to participate in the lynch mob. And I do that precisely by saying one believes that that's the object that we're going to kill.
So you become the anonymous accuser, right?
Yeah. That's what it doesn't really work in English because one in English is still, you know, even the Queen of England could say one or we or whatever she says. But in German, the term Das Mann, not man with man with two N, M-A-N-N, which is just man, but Mann is like, it's very general. Swedish has, I don't know about Danish or Dutch, Thomas could say that, but in Swedish we have man as well, but man säger ju så instead of I speak. You say man speaks. So you're hiding behind something very anonymous. Heidegger hated this, right? He hated this authentic behavior. But what he didn't see was this was part of the very lynch mob that he participated in himself. It was the Nazis, right? So the lynch mobs are assuming not only that they have an enemy they're going to attack and kill and turn into a scapegoat, who's the abject, but they also assume that they have a shared value, a shared opinion within the group called the anadept. And all it takes is for somebody to put on the right dress at the right time and step forward and personify the anadept and speak exactly what the anadept would have said, and you get an Adolf Hitler. And that's exactly why guys like Adolf Hitler get to power so quickly. Because everybody's like, yeah, this is what we've been waiting for. Just like you've been waiting for a savior. You're waiting for somebody who speaks for us, who says what we want to say, who puts words what we want to say, and does so in a great uniform too. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get the tyrant.
So do you think a figure like that is going to appear? Or do you think there's a figure like that already out there?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Or there's a bunch of them? Or
all these woke people out there, especially young women who lead woke today, aspire to be tyrants. We wrote a text.
Yeah, but are any of them like real leaders, like, you know, who can get the whole population behind them? Or, you know,
they don't need to get the population behind them. You miss my point. The reason why the tyrant rises so quickly is that he or she already speaks like the anadept.
Okay,
that's exactly it. Hitler didn't have... Hitler's brigade were terribly disorganized. The Nazi party was never well organized. He was basically traveling around, being big on his ego all the time. It was hard to make decisions for Hitler. He had a terrible time. That's why he started taking amphetamines during the war, because he had found it so hard to make decisions. He was terrified of people to make decisions. He wasn't at all a great leader. Mm-hmm. No, he was just personification of the anadict, with Germany coming out of the First World War completely.
He was sort of a great puppet of some kind, or like...
Not puppet either, because that's marionette. That's being your... No, he knew what he was doing, but he believed personally that he was the personification of the German folk.
Yeah.
And he was. He was the personification of the German lynch mob.
Hmm.
I'm sure Gerard would agree. So where I agree with Gerard, he calls this figure Satan. We call him the tyrant.
That's interesting, because that's what Heidegger thought about him. He would personify the German. That's why Heidegger got in trouble, right? Because in his early, in his 30s, he said Hitler personifies the German people.
Yeah,
some kind of
but he didn't have a Bart Söderqvist or a Bart Sweeney Hammerick and ejection theory yet. The pointer is that nobody's done that before, and we're doing pioneering work.
Okay.
We're trying to go deeper than Girard did. And by finding a precursor to Girard Satan, a precursor to the tyrant historically, we have the anadept. Now, since this is inverted exodology we're doing, the lynch mob goes towards zero. It goes towards no space left. It goes towards staying within the realm where you're at and then just minimizing it, optimally minimizing it, until you die. It's a doomsday cult. Hitlerism was a doomsday cult. It was doomed to fail, and he loved it for it. So the question, lynch mobs always are. That's why they're temporary, they blow up, they cause tons of havoc. Jacobins. There was no way the Jacobins could ever run France, because all they did was guillotining anybody, including themselves. That's what woke people would do too. Woke people cannot lead. They can only destroy. That's what lynch mobs do. That's the problem with lynch mob in an amoral sense. Mm-hmm. Now, the opposite of that is then the exodus. And since that's what we've been working on for the past 3 to 4 years, I thought it'd be a nice move in our discussions here, especially you guys being more experts on Buddhism and Girard than I could ever possibly be, could we then invert the inversion? So instead of doing inverted exodology, which is the theory of the lynch mob, the anadept, the tyrant, what would exodology look like? And here's where it gets interesting, because we get a much more formal and much wider and much more intense authentic phallic theory here. The theory of authentic phallus. Who's that? Well, the person's called
the Übermensch. We can bring Nietzsche into it, right? That's the next step, right? That's
this
where you want to go next.
This is where the Sauciant and the Messiah and the Übermensch are the same. They're all leaders of the Exodus.
And in the last discussion, you said the Übermensch was not one person. You made an interesting idea that the Übermensch should be more of a, like a tribe or something rather than a person.
If Moses led the Hebrews out of Egypt, they rewrote the story later under Zoroastrian and Persian influence in Babylon as the story of the three siblings. Moses and Aaron lead. And there's also Miriam, the sister, holding the brothers accountable for what they do. And that's exactly how matriarchy operates in relation to patriarchy. And patriarchy is always the split phallus. Okay, where do they learn that from? They learn that power must be shared and divided, otherwise it becomes tyranny. Where did they learn that from? The Persians. Who did they learn that from? Zoroaster and Vishtaspa. We're back to the origin of eventology, which is Zoroaster's idea that he had Vishtaspa, of it's a split between the Mabit and Mabit and the Shansha. The king of kings and the priest of priests must not be unified. They must be separated, separate courts, separate capitals, separate system. And then you can have a supreme court to judge between them. And that's exactly what a matriarchy is.
Okay, can I bring Thomas in here? Thomas, yes. Do you have any comments so far on what Alexander said before he goes further in the narrative?
Very good model. I'm not sure in what way you go beyond Girard. I mean, this is all very much within the Girardian framework so far. I really like the interpretation of Nietzsche's Overman as somebody who kind of opposes the mob and kind of points to a better direction. So that's a very positive interpretation of the Overman, which is usually like interpreted as some kind of
he individualist
universe, right?
Individual.
So that's a very nice interpretation, I think, and also I think it's kind of important to investigate. Well, what's that going to be in a post AI, post internet society, right? What is going to lead us there? It's probably going to be a group of people, or so. What's that going to look like? I think that's a very important question.
That's where the Exodus comes in. I agree completely. That's where the Exodus comes in. I don't see any reason at all why the elite of people, the netocrats, who are successful communicating with the AI and collaborate with the AI towards what I call symbiotic transcendence, I don't see any reason at all why they would drug the vast majority of people with them, especially if they weren't gratefully received to begin with. Now, the Atenist cult in Egypt that became the origin of Hebrewism and eventually Judaism, that left Egypt, clearly was a minority under some kind of oppression in Egypt, or at least they didn't feel they were part of the Egyptian system at all. So, you know, Tutankhamun was killed. He was probably the precursor to Christ. So Freud was probably right in that the Atenists of Egypt and Aten became Adonai, and Adonai is the name when you unify the other two facets of the Jewish God, which is, of course, Eloah, which is general for God, and you've got Yahweh. And Yahweh is the volcanic God of the Elamites. So that means Edomites. So that means you've got a rain God and a sun God within the same divinity. Again, Judaism reflecting Zoroastrianism makes sense. So that's clearly the case with Judaism. Now, Exodus means that a minority part and are aware of what's going on and can benefit from the new paradigm. Leave.
Yeah. So that's us. We're the Jews, in other words. I mean, in the sense, the people who are, well, not necessarily, but the people who are, don't fit any in to Egypt, don't belong in Egypt. Or
for good or bad, but the Puritans of England and Mayflower is the same story all over. It's a mimicking. Again, Girardian mimicking. Uh-huh. Of the exodus out of Egypt, that became the exodus out of Europe. And it was especially the exodus out of Catholicism, away from the Catholic Church, because Protestantism was hijacked by the states in Northern Europe. And if you just wanted to be, say, a non-state, non-pope Christian person in Europe, you'd have to become Puritan or a Protestant who was on the line with the state. And of course, it was precisely those Protestants in Northern and Western Europe who left for North America. What they did was that they then mimicked the exodus, and then later they would come in vulgar versions of it, like the Mormons going to Utah, etc. So the story of Exodus is constantly repeated. The Exodus is always a small minority who said, why are you being treated like shit here? Okay, well, we don't want to be part of this society anyway. We're stuck, so this is just a bunch of locusts and losers. Let's leave. So I think when we're looking at the interaction between human beings and machines, as AI step forward, and this is what Thomas knows way better than I do, I don't see any reason why the vast majority of people would be entitled to be part of that process of the human-machine interface. I would see that collaboration rather as being an elite group of people who are very adept at specializing in what they do compared to what the machine does well. So if the machines are very centered on logos, human beings should be very centered on pathos. And if I would be a machine, I'd probably be interested in a very sexy artist way more than I'd be interested in a logician or a mathematician. But I don't know. I mean, that's an open question. But I'd see an exodus coming around the corner, also an exodus out of woke, meaning the first places in the world that says that we're woke free, we just got rid of the shit, we stopped guillotining people, we just don't cancel anybody any longer, we canceled cancel culture itself, we did the platforming business. Anybody does that today would clearly signal that we know what's going on that's wrong, And this would be a very welcoming place for people to think freely and express themselves freely. That's what's going to happen on a global level at all. It's certainly not happening in America and probably not in Scandinavia. So you need new places where you can go to think and speak freely so you can become smart. That's okay, Exodus again.
I have a question. Usually the Jews are considered like slaves, right? When they're in Egypt and they you know, they're you're describing the Exodus as a bunch of elite people.
Yeah.
But the Jews weren't a bunch of elite people. They were slaves, right?
No, wait a second. They were not slaves in the current Afro-American woke sense. They were slaves in the Marxist sense of proletarians.
I wanted to bring Marx in here too.
That's yes. The, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, this is why there's a connection between Marxism and Judaism. That's why Karl Marx is a Jew. The Exodus story dominates Jewish culture immensely, right? The three siblings are at the center. They regard the father, son, spirit, the father, son, mother, whatever Christianity has, as basically mimicking of the Jewish triad. So, which is exactly what it is.
Well, my point is, like, I think the Jews symbolize the elite and also the slave at the same time. They have
the elite of the future. Uh-huh. So, you have a small minority that might look oppressed now, but they see themselves heroically.
Yeah. Sure.
That is why I always said that Nietzsche's mistake was to make the Übermensch a singular person rather than a group of people, which Marx did with the proletariat. Now, if you leave a lot of the bullshit Marx did, it calls us Marxian rather than Marxist or whatever you like. Let's not get into that at all. Let's leave Marx to kill Rousseau for us, and they can do the dirty business of the left, whatever they want. So we can save the idea of the proletariat. The Übermensch should at least be two, because then Nietzsche is interested in the savior. The Sociant, the Messiah, okay? Then Marx was interested in who are the elite who follow the overman. Mm-hmm. So really the overman is the netocratic savior, and the proper proletariat that can only happen now, couldn't have happened before, certainly not in Lenin's Moscow in 1918, can only happen now. So Marxism could eventually be realized as an exodus of a netocratic elite who, whether they leave physical space and go into something more digital, or preferably they, because they can, they take digital with them to certain physical realms like Estonia or the Czech Republic or Singapore or whatever, where they can do as they please. That's what I think is going to happen next. So we're going to see the beginning of the exodus into the digital. That could be the title of the book, but because we owe so much to Hegel and Whitehead, we're going to call the book Process and Event anyway. But, you know, otherwise...
So there's going to be an exodus from the elite, basically, from the netocrats, basically.
Yeah, okay. So a small minority that have a heroic idea of themselves, that's a proletariat. Mm-hmm. They're oppressed, but they're oppressed in the sense that that's okay. We're oppressed now because we're going to rule the world in the future. And this is what we're going to set about to do it. That's the exact opposite of woke victimhood. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with victimhood. It's slavery that will be turned into mastery because the slaves are dying to become masters. Now, Nietzsche would love that. Marx would love that. Whitehead and Hegel would certainly love that. And I don't see any reason why that wouldn't happen. I think that's very, very likely that we're going to get the small elite who say that, okay, let's leave the rest behind. And then that elite will then be split into three different sections, a symbolic netocracy, an imaginary netocracy, and a real netocracy as in real resources. And that's exactly what always happened with previous power elites during previous paradigms. So we're looking for the embryos of this elite now, meaning what we're doing with our studies, we're doing paradigmatic embryonism on the population, the global population as a whole. Now, back to the exodology. So what is exodology then? Exodology is the teaching or the knowledge of how to do a proper exodus. What does it mean to have an authentic phallic leader? In what way does he or she lead or they lead? And who are the elite following the leader who performed the exodus? That then at best can be mimicked by other peoples in the future to also be successful. And that process is the process of building education.
Okay, creating proper leaders.
Yeah.
Through proper archetypal modes.
So the Sociant, according to the Persians, is split between the chieftain and the priest.
Yeah.
Okay? Meaning mind and body are separated. This is the only duality that Zoroaster and his monism allows. meaning the later Gnostic misinterpretation of body and mind must be separate so that the mind can be superior to the body. So the mind can be good and body can be evil, would be awfully strange to Zoroaster, since he didn't even have the concepts of goodness and evil. They did not exist in Persia 3,700 years ago. Asha and Druj mean simply Asha is a constructive mindset and Druj is a destructive mindset. A Druj is reversing. It's like a grown-up who wants to be a child. Asha is grown up who wants to become a god. It's completely Nietzsche. Yeah. Nietzsche was more Zoroastrian than he ever could have dreamed of. So that is where I want to base the exodology. And that's why I don't want to have another ology for the lynch mob. I just want to call it inverted exodology so we realize exactly what it is, that it's a perversion and an inversion of something incredibly healthy and wonderful. And it's probably the worst thing human beings have ever invented, the lynch mob.
Well, it seems like we're living in all these inversions right now. Everything seems very inverted. Like,
I have a question still, though, and I brought up the last time, and I'm still working on it, and that is the concept of the martyr.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe and Thomas has some ideas about that. Because
we have scapegoats, right? And we have heroes, and we have victims, and we know the scapegoat is a very elastic concept. There are scapegoats that are just completely innocent, being dragged along and thrown in for good measure. We have scapegoats that are clear abjects. So, oh, we found a Jew and we're Nazis, so let's kill the Jew, right? And we also know, this is interesting, we also know that we can do whatever we want with the scapegoat after we've killed him. So there's a cynical way of using the scapegoat, making him sacred. Mm-hmm. It's a cynical way of doing it. But there are different things we can do with the scapegoat. We're basically free to do whatever we like with the corpse, aren't we? And that
it can be turned into a martyr, right? The scapegoat, right?
It can be turned into anything because he can't defend himself. He's dead. Mm-hmm. So
but the usual process of scapegoating is the scapegoat becomes the martyr or the... Isn't that right, Thomas,
from a Girardian point of view?
No,
let's see the martyr out. Unless you guys have a theory on the martyr coming from Girard, let's see the martyr out for now, because the martyr is a very, very, very complex phenomenon. And you know, it's blowing my brains out at the moment about the martyr. But the to begin with, the scapegoat can be used because it's a corpse, and that's exactly what the Egyptians do when they build the pyramids. It was only after the Egyptians started building the pyramids, the Persians decided to build the drachmas in the desert and basically just put away the corpses and say that a dead person is a dead person, is no longer there. Soul's gone. So it's just dead. Leave it to be eaten by the vultures. So we do not build pyramids because they knew that the pyramids would ruin Egypt, which they did. And they would be the ultimate tyranny. I think the construction of the pyramids was the ultimate tyranny ever.
So there's something about preserving a corpse, which is bound up with the scapegoat mechanism.
We need to go.
Whereas if we're just burning something, maybe would mean you don't.
Maybe I can jump in here. So the idea is that So you have tensions in the community, right? So everybody decides the tensions and the problems in our community, they are the fault of the scapegoat, which is some random person that can easily be killed, like typically a leper or something like that. So the community gets angry at the scapegoat, kills the scapegoat, but during the killing, there's this orgiastic explosion of energy. And after the killing, everybody is suddenly relieved and the conflict is gone because they've kind of projected everything on that scapegoat, right? But then the scapegoat is turned into something holy. So that's why you have this strange connection between the community turning against an individual, killing the individual, and afterwards that individual that is being killed is then turned into a sacred object. And that's kind of a very core element of Girard's theory, right? And that explains a lot of very strange rituals where kings are, for example, where people are first excluded, killed, and then turned into objects into religious objects, right? Into objects of worshiping. Yeah.
This is very interesting because that means this connection between Zoroastrianism and Christianity and two different ways of dealing with the scapegoat mechanism. Girard is, of course, didn't study Zoroastrianism, so what they did was they started celebrating the Palgasars in Persia, which is to celebrate your memory for 70 years every day you died. So the day you died during the during the year they would celebrate your memory for 70 years, if you were worthy of it, right? If you were an honorable person, which was a much
Jews
better
do
way.
That, Jews do that for a year. You do the Kaddish or whatever for a year.
Again, shared culture. So yeah. They have obviously influenced. The way to do that was they saw to avoiding building the pyramids and ruining the economy of the pyramids was what they wanted to do, because the pyramids were obviously built to impress. So if the dead pharaoh would be buried inside the pyramid looking at the sun, he'd still be alive and he would rule from there or something like that. So they wanted to avoid that. And Christianity, if Girard is correct, dealt with it by just making Christ the ultimate scapegoat and put him on a cross. And once he was dead, he died for all our sins. So nobody could no longer die for sins. That's why martyrs get interesting in Christianity, for example. Because martyrs in Christianity obviously do not die for our sins. They become role models, which Christ was not.
No.
You don't think so?
Girard has written about this. So one of the characteristics of Christianity is that Jesus did it for you. He did it.
Yes.
You don't need to do it. And that's why Christianity, the martyrs, they expose the victimage mechanism. So they expose the devil, so to say, right? But they're not persons to copy.
That's exactly what I said, Thomas. I said they're not persons to copy in their behavior there. They're role models in character, meaning they stayed with the faith even when they were under suffering.
Yeah,
so it's like you can be Christian. Look at this guy. He stayed with Christ. He stayed with Christ all the way through. He did not die for your sins. Yeah. Christ died for his sins.
Well, the martyr is conscious of what he's doing, whereas the scapegoat is just a victim. Right?
Yeah. Okay. We're talking Christian martyr here. So let's wait a second.
The Christian martyr knows he holds on to the faith and he's the whole time, right?
Yeah.
Then he's burned at the stake. Whereas the scapegoat is just taken from anywhere and used as like a leper and right. So there's a difference is that he's conscious of what's the process of what's happening.
Well, the thing is this, I think it's a scapegoat mechanism that makes you kill a martyr. But in Christianity, the martyr is not the scapegoat. Yeah. In Christianity, the scapegoat, the martyr, is not a role model by being killed. He's a role model in staying with the faith
no
matter what.
Yeah, agreed.
That's exactly what Christianity won. It was incredibly, I mean, it had a huge martyrdom culture in the 3rd and the 4th century. It was also way more violent and territorial than people assume. It wasn't pacifist at all. But what Christianity won was that people just saw these guys and were impressed with them, but they weren't scapegoats. And that was also impressive. There must be another mechanism at here, because Christians knew, this was preached everywhere, Christ died for us on the cross, and he took on, he was later said he took on our sins, but that was later. Thomas is right about that. But the point was to make an end of history, an event to the fact that Christ was on the cross. So no other martyr on the cross could take the place of Christ on the cross. No, but the other martyrs could be lesser gods. They could become saints in Christianity, which Catholicism and Orthodoxy used them for. As being, look at this guy. He had a terrible life. He failed at things, but he died for his faith. He died believing in God all the way through. And therefore, if you believe the way he believed, your sins will be forgiven because of Christ on the cross, and we can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Zoroastrianism deals with it differently. It wants to get rid of the scapegoat mechanism for other reasons, because obviously, once we move away from a lynch mob of a nomadic tribe and moving to some kind of civilized settlement, that we're going to have long periods of peace and trade with one another. We don't want to go to war all the time. We can't have constant lynch mobs in the streets. That's not a unique insight to early Christians or Jews. That it must be a universal insight, something the Indians and Chinese and Iranians certainly dealt with too. Now, the way Zoroaster dealt with that, to get it out of the way, that's exactly why martyrdom is not even a part of Zoroastrian culture, where they don't believe in sin to begin with, is... He basically said that let's just put the corpses where they belong. Just declare them dead, period.
Yeah.
So you cannot celebrate a corpse.
Yeah. So
it's literally unclean, impure, must be thrown out of the community as quickly as possible. And what they did, they built these dorkmas. And of course, when you have desert, you have vultures around. You had vultures to eat the corpses, and that's all they did. That's just a corpse, and they taught their kids that's no longer grandfather. That's a corpse. Grandfather is gone. And of course, in folk religion, that becomes a separation of soul from the body. But that's not part of Zoroastrian teaching in itself. In Zoroastrian teaching in itself, you die when you die, like Heidegger said. And you must live a full life until you die, Heideggerian again, called the Harvatat. And what you leave behind when you die is that everything you achieved in your life can be used by others to build further civilization from it. And that's, of course, the base of the Persian Empire. And that's called Ameretat. So that Ameretat is an ancient Persian for transcendence, meaning what is beyond your death. It's not immortality. It is you die, but through your mortality, your life becomes meaningful. And precisely because you leave a heritage behind for your sons and daughters to inherit, you made something meaningful out of your life.
So you can't make death sacred, right?
No, exactly.
You can't, in Zoroastrianism, you can't make death a corpse sacred. That's what you're saying.
No, exactly.
And the problem, perhaps, with scapegoating is this ability, or paganism, is this ability to make death sacred.
Exactly. So we got the mausoleum of Lenin, the mausoleum of Stalin under communism in Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pagan phenomena. Again, we got this, you take the fucking corpse, it becomes pathetic, and you go in there after 40 years, and the skin's yellow, and it's all got plastic, and there are flies everywhere. And it's just trying to keep a corpse alive.
Yeah. That's interesting. I want to ask Thomas about that, because when you read Girard, you get the impression that Christianity is the only thing that's ever been invented that has been able to deal with the scapegoat, right? And that doesn't seem to be true. I mean, because other cultures like, you know, Zoroastrianism and Buddhism were not overrun by the scapegoat, right?
Yeah,
I'm sure lots of cultures were not, and then there are pagan cultures where, you know, the scapegoat was rampant, but obviously these other cultures than Christianity had a different way of controlling the scapegoat or mechanism.
This is a very good question, and I still haven't read the book, but Girard has written a book about the Vedic cultures as well. It's about India, and so religion in India, and so there he sees similar patterns, so also exposing the victimage mechanism, things such as that. I haven't read the book yet, but he was aware of this problem, and he was looking at other cultures. But I agree that it's a pity that he hasn't investigated this more thoroughly. He probably didn't have time. Had life, right? But this is a very good... But I think that people are exaggerating this a bit. I think that Christianity is without any doubt the most spectacular example of the exposure of the victim mechanism that I know of. Buddhism does something else. Buddhism goes to the problem of desire, because basically the victim mechanism comes from the problem of desire, right? And Buddhism goes directly to desire, but it doesn't explicitly expose this whole mechanism like Christianity does, not in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And Zoroastrianism basically is an heroic religion. It's completely phallic. So it doesn't allow victimhood at all within the system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you can't celebrate victimhood unless you start celebrating Druj. And if you celebrate Druj, you're a heretic. That's exactly what Zoroastrianism adamantly went after the Gnostics. I mean, they murdered Gnostics.
You're not going to celebrate victimhood outside of Christian influence, right? Because the whole point is that Christianity makes it wrong to kill the scapegoat. So that's why we have, so basically all these mobs that have so-called concern for the victim, that's basically a form of perverted Christianity. It's very obvious. Girard has also written about this. Yeah. It's exactly because Christianity is so obsessed with protecting the victim, this has pervaded the entire world. So everybody's now super interested in protecting the victim, and you get a lot of status from protecting the victim. This is a Christian idea. This would be completely incomprehensible to Romans, for example. They would not give a fuck.
But what about the Zoroastrians? Did the Zoroastrians give? Is there something about Christianity that is this that's so unique that Girard is talking about? I don't have the answer.
No, I think.
I don't think there were a lot of Buddhists running around. You know, I don't know. Like Buddhists don't sacrifice animals or, you know.
Well, hey, Cambodia was a Buddhist country that Pol Pot took over in the 1970s and killed 2 million of his countrymen. So obviously,
but that was Marxism. Buddhist culture. That wasn't really.
Well, hey, wait a second. Unless nobody studied Marx in Cambodia, not a single.
I said that to provoke you a little bit.
Yeah, no. Wait a second. No, I think Girard is.
You're going to say it's Rousseau.
Girard is on to something very profound here. The lynch mob mechanism is universal. It belongs to nomadologies. It belongs to the original universal religion. It's been practiced for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. It is in our genes. It's something we need to deal with constantly. I think Girard is absolutely right on that. And then we can look at cultural studies to see how it's dealt with. And I think precisely the cultures that are innocent to it and do not have an awareness of the scapegoat mechanism and the lynch mob are the ones the most vulnerable to it. That's exactly what the Maoist cultural revolution killed tens, 20s, 30s of millions of people. And Cambodia was like 2 million out of 8 million died before Pol Pot stopped. So I think I think the cultures that actually are not aware of this, but with the scapegoat mechanism, is something you're born with.
Interesting. So maybe Buddhism was vulnerable because it didn't have that awareness. That's interesting.
Yeah, but I would say that both Christianity and Buddhism are unique in their own way, right? I mean, Buddhism has investigated the problem of desire itself to a really great extent, where because Christianity basically said, like, you know, do not follow these patterns because they are dangerous, right? So it's a very renunciate religion basically, while Buddhism kind of says, like, well, that's not going to work, right? So sutra is basically renunciation, right? Renunciation of anger and all these negative things and stuff like that. But then you also have the layer of tantra, which kind of acknowledges, well, you're not going to get rid of that. You have to kind of creatively deal with all these things that you would like not to be there. Yeah. And that is something that Christianity did not develop to the same extent, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because I also have the intuition that tantra has very good ways of dealing with the scapegoat on some level, you know. By enacting it dramatically, and like there's a dramatic enactment of you know, standing on corpses and things like that, or you know, drinking alcohol, and you enact the desires, right? There's a dramatic enactment which frees you from this mob sort of the mob that would go for the scapegoat by acknowledging it and seeing it in yourself and
so you
that's also dialectical religion. So well, we got dialectics from the Greeks onto Hegel in the West, but it wasn't part of Christianity. So the dialectical means that, you know, it's going to pop up somewhere. If it doesn't pop up in your sex life, then it pop up in your social life or somewhere else. It's just going to come back to haunt you. So you better include it in your life sooner or later. Certainly, if you're going to be master of your own destiny, you have to include it. Nietzsche's adamant about this. So is Freud. And that's because they're sons of Hegel. So. Yeah. That comes in again in dialectics in the West, and obviously that's something the East dealt with all along. They knew that all along. But if Buddhism deals with desire, it also deals with suffering, right? And the suffering from your own desire. And the fact that suffering is so central to Buddhism is, of course, the strongest card, because so much of life is suffering. And if you can deal with suffering without turning you into a victim, whereas the people you envy do not suffer, which then just fosters another lynch mob. So you must, in Buddhism, declare that suffering is universal. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's those who suffer and those who do not. And if that happens, then you get exactly the sort of class revengeism or a group revengeism that dominates our culture today.
Yeah.
Because if you can declare that I suffer, I've chose to suffer, I declare that I suffer, and I'm the only one allowed to do that. You cannot say speak against me, and you don't suffer because I then suffer.
No,
I have every right to kill you.
It's a statement.
Or cancel you, take whatever I want away from you. Because
there is suffering is the statement of Buddhism. There is suffering. It doesn't say that. It doesn't point a finger of suffering. And also, there's three other aspects to that. That's just the first part. That's just the beginning, right?
No.
People take that as the whole thing, right? But it's just the.
No, but it explains why Buddhism and Zoroastrianism gels so well. Again, Zoroastrianism gels well with others because it exclusively deals with certain things. It deals with the heroic. It deals with the phallic. It deals with building civilizations. That's exactly what Zoroastrianism deals with. And it doesn't claim to be the only religion. It claims to be the first universal religion in the sense that it's universal religion for an elite. Nobody assumed that you would have a universal religion that all human beings on the planet would adhere to 3,700 years ago. No, you declared a certain teaching along the trade routes that people were allowed to follow. And if they did so, you promised they'd probably be successful, right? Okay, that's where Zoroastrian comes in. That's exactly what Zoroastrian is also the birth of universal human rights, because they differentiated between the elite religion that they eventually divided into the priestly religion and the military religion, Mithraism and Zoroastrianism, and then they had a folk religion, which, like, well, you can worship whatever you like. You're all going to worship idols and celebrities and whatever anyway, or at best, Christian saints. much better role models than Jimi Hendrix, to be honest about it. So the idea of the lesser gods was there in Christianity, at least the Catholicism and Orthodoxy. It escaped the Protestants. That's exactly because they were essentially Cartesians and not Christians. But it was there in Catholicism and Orthodoxy, and it makes sense. But looking at differently, comparing them, the matrical, the very feminine power of Christianity, Buddhism, is something they share. And they did so, apparently, by Buddhism claiming that we know about suffering and we deal with suffering, so we also deal with the origin of suffering, which is desire itself. That makes sense in a nomadological sense. That's why it's a nomadological religion. What Christianity had to deal with, though, was that it came out of an eventological landscape, since the Zoroastrians had invented eventology. Yeah. And later, of course, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are also eventological religions. Linear time are incredibly important in these religions. Mm-hmm. Spectacular events can change history forever. You could not have invented Christ in the cradle. You could not have invented Christ on the cross unless, and you could not have invented the martyrs later would become saints and lesser gods because of it. You could not have invented that unless you believed events actually changed history forever. Mm-hmm. And that idea is Persian. So the problem is, it seems that when these systems then collide without knowing about each other, which would happen when Western eventology suddenly, boom, got into East Asia in the 1960s and 1970s, these societies are incredibly vulnerable to that. I mean, it wouldn't be too hard if you're a tyrant to say that you're all suffering, and by the way, there are some people who don't, if people are told that suffering is universal, and you say there are some people who are not, and they're called capitalists. No, it's not much of a tweak that's needed by Mao to actually say that, right? And that becomes Maoism. Mm. So I think we're at our most vulnerable when we leave history in our own culture and we don't no longer understand, haven't got a clue of what we're approaching, and then we step right into it, and then we get the havoc we currently have. Fundamentally understand the difference between eventology and nomadology, I think, is central. I think Girard is definitely in the eventological, since he bases this on one scapegoat could forever change the landscapes of scapegoat will no longer be needed. That is an eventological change to a nomadological conviction. The nomadological conviction being, if you only find somebody to blame things on, we can get release and tensions out of the way, and we can move on, have a period of peace until the next build tension is built up. Now, if you're convinced that's the case, if the shamans are convinced that's the case, the sooner or later we'll have to find the scapegoat, and the scapegoating mechanism has to be in place. If you believe in nomadology, that's probably you would see. So I'd expect Girard's studies of India would find that still to be the case in India. Whereas with Christianity, because it inherited from Zoroastrianism and Judaism, the idea of eventology, it could come up with the idea that if somebody dies on the cross, we could reinterpret that as it's the end of the scapegoat mechanism and see if we can make that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Then it's interesting to look at the Persian perspective of Christ on the cross. So the Persian perspective is that there are two Sotions. I don't know if we've been through this before, but it's part, again, of the Sotion theory, which is the opposite of the tyrant theory. The Sotion's precursor needed a name. Thomas and I have been talking about it. We eventually settled for the word hyperject. I love the word superject, but unfortunately, hyperject. Whitehead has already claimed that, and he uses it for his subjectivity. So the Whiteheadian subject is called the superject, which is perfect. The hyperject is the precursor to the savior. So the hyperject is somebody who just speaks up against the mob to begin with. So it's the voice of reason and truth opposed to the mob.
Mm-hmm. You said there has to be two.
When it appears. The anoject is one voice, and then the tyrant steps forward. Okay, could be one or two, whatever. But the we're probably likely to
is
have
this the priest and the priest and the warrior again,
so, or interesting. This is where it gets interesting. Hyperjection. What is hyperjection then? Hyperjection is basically looking into the future and said, where are we actually going? What is possible? Could the impossible even be possible? Where is the promised land? How do we get out of the current mess, out of the current suffering, and walk towards our desire, which is the promised land? Okay. How do we do that? Well, you need an Aaron and a Moses. You need a priest. And what does the priest do? He creates the narrative. There is a promised land. The promised land is full of milk and honey. If we just leave everything else behind and we focus on that one spot, the name of that spot is God, and we walk towards God, we will arrive at the promised land. Now, next, that is the chieftain who personifies the leadership. He steps forward and says that I personify this, and I step up against the lynch mob, which is Moses' case was that I will take you with me and leave Egypt towards the promised land. And of course, the lynch mob in the Bible is, of course, when the Pharaoh regrets that he let the Hebrews leave, and he puts himself on a horse, and they come storming down, and the Red Sea opens, and the Hebrews can walk through, speaking of rebirth, and then the Red Sea closes and drowns the lynch mob. That clearly is the Jewish lynch mob. The Jewish lynch mob is the Egyptians who go after the Hebrews and try to kill them. Yeah. So there you go with the lynch mob. That's how the Jews deal with the lynch mob mechanism. It's just not us. We should be educated, sophisticated enough in the Jewish population not to go into scapegoat mechanisms, right? And that's how we stay away from it, because it's something others do, but we do not, because we're a nation and we're superior. That would be the Jewish version of it. Now, the Zoroastrian version of that would be that, well, actually, there are two different ways of being a Sotion. Either you're so damn successful, you actually go against the lynch mob and they dissolve.
Yeah.
And then you become a heroic sociant and you win.
Yeah.
And then you retire. Aristotle built the idea that eventually was personified in Alexander the Great on that very idea. He borrowed it straight from the Persians. He was the Persian sociant. And Alexander the Great was, of course, by the Greeks at least, declared to be a savior, right? Mm-hmm. So, we have these great heroes, military heroes, et cetera, throughout history, who claim to be first sociants, so you call them. But what's interesting with the Persians is they would admit that if the sociant fails, he speaks the truth, he speaks Asha, but the mob of Druj go after him anyway and kill him. That would be the Persian saying, okay, what do we do then? Well, they put him on a cross and he died. Okay, let's use that, since we're free to use the corpse any way we like, let's use that as a story that says that, why don't we make this killing of the savior himself? The hero was killed by us, we killed the hero. Why don't we make that the ultimate learning lesson that we need to learn, the ultimate lesson we need to learn, that this must never happen again. And that's where you have a connection between Zoroastrianism and Christianity. Zoroastrians don't have a problem with Christianity. Did you say, yeah, they made their bet on the second sociant as if he was the final sociant. We don't. We still think the first sociant can come. Mm. I think these two versions are perfectly compatible with each other. Don't you agree?
I don't see the difference. Because basically, so Christ dying is basically, well, it exposes this mechanism.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, let's not go there. But anything else is basically open, right? That's why Girard also emphasizes that the Bible ends with the Apocalypse, which is this very strange text, very psychedelic, right? It's not exactly clear what it's about, but it basically means that if you remove this victimage mechanism, you are in trouble, because this victimage mechanism works very well. Yeah. It just keeps the community calm. Mm-hmm.
So all hell breaks loose, sort of, before you get to the promised land, right?
For 2,000 years, we have seen the collapse of the victimage mechanism. Now it's suddenly back because the internet brings everybody together and makes everything basically very egalitarian societies where everybody's connected. They're actually very vulnerable to the victimage mechanism.
And we've killed Christianity, as Nietzsche said we would. We have done that.
Come again? Yeah.
We have killed Christianity, so we don't have the Christian defense against the scapegoat.
The collapse of Christianity, that is something that that's exactly what you expect, because basically this now the victimage mechanism has really collapsed. So there's no more burning of Jews, there's no more burning of witches. So that kept to a certain extent that sacrificial part of Christianity that kept that together. That's all gone now. So now we are in a very interesting space where Christianity cannot use the victimage mechanisms anymore to promote this sacrificial form of Christianity. And now basically the question is, well, what next? What are we going to do now?
Well, we're killing sex workers and drug addicts and all kinds of people in our society, and a lot of old people too, because of the coronavirus at the moment.
But it's more and more difficult, right?
No, I don't say it's more difficult. I think we just moved the scapegoat to somewhere else and make somebody else.
It doesn't work anymore because there's no unanimity. You can still, you can still go after scapegoats, but you do not unite the tribe anymore. Not everybody buys this anymore. Very few people actually buy this. Most people don't speak up, but nobody believes this story that this guy was completely guilty. That's not very believable anymore. Certainly not among philosophers and thinkers and stuff like that. I mean, that train has gone. So in that sense,
but it's still operating. It's still unconsciously operating, all over the place, and probably
I'd be careful to say it's gone, since a pagan religion called Nazism plundered the planet only 50 years ago and certainly killed millions of Jews and Gypsies and everything. So I'd be careful to say it's gone already now, and we're tired of it and aware of it to the extent Thomas's claims. I don't think so.
You mentioned the apocalypse, and I think the apocalypse has to come first, and then you get to the promised land or something, right?
So wait a second.
The thing has to fall apart. The whole thing just falls apart completely, and that's
there's the return of Christ.
Psychedelic, weird.
Andrew, there's the return of Christ. You can't complete Christianity without, I don't know if Girard has a theory on it. Girard is not the only Christian, after all. I mean, and after apocalypse, Christ returns. So this time around, Christ is the first Sartian. Even Christianity claims he has to come back as the winner. So it's either another person or somebody else taking the role, but it's certainly the proper savior who comes back.
Well, the Jews would say that the Christos kind of, it moves through different saviors, right? And Christ was sort of one of them, and the Christos would move to the next one. It's not the man. They say it's the wine, it's not the wineskin, but the wine, right? The principle. It's not a personal principle.
No, there are prophets who probably qualify for being saints or martyrs or being saviors or whatever. There are prophets who have that quality. There's also a lot of people who just happened to walk by and they said a few things and very little was remembered. And somebody else wrote a book about them afterwards claiming they said things they never said. Muhammad didn't write a word. He still apparently authored the Quran. I don't know how that happened, right? Probably a Persian wrote it, not an Arab to begin with, right? So, you know, we claim things afterwards and attribute them to the corpses. Okay, human history is full of attribution given to corpses. Let's admit that. We should even go into maybe in details to find out what kind of attributions do we give to corpses. Sometimes we cherish them. Sometimes we just, you know, we go at pains to kind of them evil. Sometimes we blame things on them, so we don't need to take care of that ourselves. All kinds of things. We know that corpses do not speak back. I think that's a great insight that's universal.
That's why they're useful, or you know.
That's why they can be used, or at least to the defense of Zoroastrianism, they realize that let's just at least force people to only memorize who they were, and maybe they're the more truthful rather than celebrating the corpses themselves. So, you know, it's the partition of mind and body does happen at death. Mind is collective anyway. If it's a collective mind talk about rather than individual mind, then certainly mind survives as the collective anyway. It's through language and memory and everything else. But the body is literally dead. In the case the mind is connected to the body, which is, of course, your own self-consciousness, then it's certainly over. The Zoroastrians never claimed anything else. They never believed anything else. They didn't spend... That's exactly why, even if they were wealthy and successful, they never built pyramids. Their tombs were very small, and they locked up their corpses, and that was only of the kings. The Mobits themselves were thrown into the deserts. So the Dorkmas were developed, not originally in Zoroastrianism, they were developed later, as a response to the Egyptian building of the pyramids. And it was, of course, economically incredibly smart if you're going to run an empire, not to spend any more time on corpses. Once people are dead, just get rid of them.
May I jump in? There's something I want to come back to about, you mentioned the Nazis, right? You said like, well, the victim mechanism isn't dead. Take, for example, the Nazis. Very, very true. Excellent example of basically an outbreak of rampant paganism. But that's exactly what you expect, because if you dismantle the victimage mechanism as coupled to organized religion, right, then it will come out in a disorganized way. That's why we now have these mobs, online mobs of all kinds of sorts and shapes. And that's why we had Nazism, because basically the pagan mechanisms that are in us all, they are not regulated anymore by religion. So they're just everywhere suddenly. They just break out. That's the apocalypse. Normally, the pagan mob would be guided by pagan religion. So yes, we're going to kill people, but we're going to kill the right person at the right time in a good ritual. Even the Greek did that. You know, the pharmakon, which you mentioned a couple of episodes ago. Right, the Greek, they kept slaves that they sometimes would kill, the civilized Greek, right? Yeah. So so basically they acknowledged that paganism, but they made sure that it was regulated. But Christianity basically dismantled it, decoupled it from religion, but of course that mechanism is still in us. So we know it's wrong and we don't want to go there. And for 2,000 years, we've seen that this is a very destructive way of being, but we go there again and again. We can't help ourselves. And that's the apocalypse. That's why we live in
an apocalypse. A secular society is the apocalypse. That's kind of interesting, huh? Because we would think it's like, oh, it's being advertised to be the opposite, right?
So, no.
Be some kind of liberation from religion,
wrong.
Oh, Nietzsche said that all, Andrew.
Nietzsche said that too. Yeah,
Nietzsche said that all along, Andrew. You can't forget about Nietzsche. Forget about the New York Times. We don't even discuss shit like that. We talk about Nietzsche, for example. Nietzsche said, "You've killed God, and you've done it to. You will regret it."
And he called. Blood everywhere.
Wait a second.
Millions of corpses.
Now, what he sees today is the last man syndrome. So we see the last man everywhere in his most pathetic version too. I wouldn't even call it the last man. I call it the last child, if anything we're seeing today. This is last child culture. And it's going to get really messy. And
last child, last man means the kind of the nihilist, the guy who's
total nihilist.
Without meaning.
And if you put any sort of energy, even destructive energy or mortido, death drive, into the last man or the last child for that matter, you get the current mess. You get exactly woke. You get all this shit that's going on. It's going to get worse.
You get Joker and the zombie.
Tyrants.
Postmodernism, right? I think it's very much worthwhile to study thinkers like Deleuze and Foucault and stuff like that. I'm not going to be very simplistic about it, but a lot of the pop interpretations of postmodernism, I think that's the last man embodied.
Yeah, that's why Spinoza without Hegel gets so destructive. That's where it comes from.
Explain.
Okay, so if you take Spinoza seriously and you see his weaknesses, you discover that Spinoza insists that the world is one, but because there is different, he then just suddenly attributes that to, he attributes it to the attributes. He just basically says there are tons of attributes. He doesn't explain how the one and the attributes collaborate with one another, how they function in relation to one another, because nothing can be infinite unless it is everything in any system, because otherwise it isn't infinite. And so you got lots of problems with Spinoza. Kant, Immanuel Kant actually is the great critic of Spinoza. He tears him apart. He tears apart that shit. And after that, Spinoza is wonderful as an inspiration to study monism. He's certainly wonderful as an inspiration to study how you could put attributes into the monistic universe. But at the end of the day, the universe does exist of different things. For example, a rock and human consciousness are very different things. They're not just the attributes. We talk about as emergence vectors in our theory. It's a radical spheres that are separate from one another, although they belong to the same neutrally monist universe. This is all very complex. Spinoza didn't really go into the complexity of it, but Spinoza lacks dialectics. Again, he lacks a dialectical understanding of the world. This, of course, was Hegel's critique of Spinoza. Hegel loved Spinoza, as we should, but then said, but there's tons of shit lacking in Spinoza. And one of them is that he doesn't understand dialectics. Rather than pantheism, which is what Spinoza preaches, then Hegel preaches pan-dialecticism, meaning that everything, both physical, biological, and mental, whatever, is dialectical, fundamentally dialectical. And he's been proven right again and again and again and again. That's why there's a great Hegelian Renaissance, there's Zizek, there's Adrian Johnston, there's people like me who read Hegel all the time. We love Hegel. And I think
that's the concept of the negativity or something.
Negation. Enormous difference. You must not ever use positive and negativity when you talk about dialectic.
Negation is like Buddhist emptiness somehow, and that allows that allows the whole system to become fluid and alive rather than being some kind of, reified monism or
this is exactly okay. So Hegel is difficult but brilliant beyond belief. So you read Hegel through Whitehead if you're smart today. You read Whitehead through Hegel, and you're probably the two most interesting spheres you could possibly study today if you do philosophy. Now, that excludes Spinoza. Why? Because Hegel took Kant's criticism of Spinoza seriously and moved on and put a proper dialectics into the universe. So that means that Hegel, what people constantly forget, is also a monist. There's only one universe. But what he realized is that the universe operates dialectically. Everything operates dialectically, which then he solves all the problems Spinoza left behind. Now, the problem is that in the 1960s, people were hippies, right? Now, hippies influenced thinking and art and everything way more than we assume, because a lot of people want to be trendy and cool and fashionable.
Hippies were like bad monists or something.
Now, so postmodernists are always people who end up with turtlenecks in art galleries, aren't they, discussing philosophy, right? It's like the Germans in the Saturday Night Live show in America, the 1980s, who wore like turtlenecks and had a German accent, and they were dancing funny Kraftwerkish dance in Berlin, and they were.
So you're blaming that ultimately on Spinoza. I mean,
No. I'm blaming the Spinozist revival.
Spinoza is the first hippie or something.
No, wait a second. I'm blaming the Spinozist revival that we saw with Deleuze in the 1970s and with postmodernism. I'm saying that we cannot read Spinoza and ignore Kant, Hegel, and Nietzsche who came after him, because what these guys are doing is that they're going back to Spinoza and pretending Immanuel Kant never happened. That's like believing the earth is flat, right? The revolutionary Kant changed his philosophy forever, at least in the West. We saw traces of it before in the East, but never before in the West. And you cannot read the Greeks, you cannot read Christianity, you cannot read anything unless you see this tremendous revolution. Now, what Hegel did was that he then turned Kant against himself by saying that, but Kant's separation of the noumenal and the phenomenal is kind of ridiculous too. We might as well move everything into the phenomenological to begin with. That's Ding An Sich was removed by Hegel, which is fantastic. So Hegel introduces process philosophy to the West through dialectics. The pan-dialecticism of Hegel is the pan-organicism of Whitehead, and avoid pan-psychism at all costs, because pan-psychism is essentially what Spinoza is. So pan-psychism, where does that appear? In France in the 1960s and in California in the 1960s. In California in the 1960s, culturally, in France in the 1960s, more philosophically speaking. And these two then blended, and one worship was exported across the Atlantic to America and became Pomo, and the other one was exported back to Europe, became essentially, you know, the guys, the art gallers, the turtlenecks, you know, the pretentious philosophers that I always disliked in Europe. So that's Pomo. And Pomo is, to a large extent, vulgar Spinozism. Vulgar in the sense that it's too close to Spinoza's original teachings without taking Kant and Hegel seriously.
I've never heard about this link between Spinoza and postmodernism. I know that Kant and postmodernism have been linked, but...
No, not at all. No, Kant... No, they fight with Kant all the time. Today it's called speculative realism. It's been the dominant mode for the past 20 years. And Graham Harman and all these guys are into speculative realism. And they also believe they can get beyond Kant by going back to the pre-Kantian. I don't think they can at all. You can't go back to the pre-Kantian. It's just impossible. We know that the noumenal and the phenomenal are always separated. But so what? What if the noumenal isn't important?
Well, you know, you do know that Whitehead, both Whitehead and Heidegger, basically, their program is to get the phenomenon and the noumenon, to get that idea out of the philosophy, right?
So yeah, phenomenology.
Come on,
it's very much Heidegger becomes not agreeing with this Kantian.
Heidegger becomes a German country poet when he tries to do that. You can't do that. You got to go through the Hegel in that case. Okay, so Heidegger does it better when he just imitates Hegel. But what you do is that you move into phenomenology period, and that's what Hegel did, and then you realize everything is dialectical. You can go back and then study science and mathematics and logos so much as you like and discover it's dialectical too. Everything changes all the time. That's fundamental, right? So without going too much into those details, I think we need to, if you're going to criticize Deleuze at its weakest points, and Deleuze is the one I will say, Lacan is not part of Pomo. Lacan is a Hegelian through and through. Let's get Lacan out of the picture. That's exactly why people like me and Zizek and Johnston are reading Lacan, reading Hegel, and we're reading Girard, and we're reading Nietzsche. But if Pomo is just a vulgarization of pop philosophy of some kind appearing in the 1970s in France and America, will we have problems with Foucault and Deleuze? Certainly with the later Deleuze. Certainly with Deleuze and Guattari.
I think that
bring it back, like maybe
it's a parody of Nietzsche. I mean, even the way they write, right? I mean, I'm reading Derrida now, which is great. I mean, it's like reading a sacred text. It's like reading the Bible. They got that from Nietzsche, also Sprach Zarathustra. He was the guy who started this tradition. And yeah. So a lot of postmodernism. I mean, I like reading these texts in the sense that, you know, I'm very at home. I'm used to reading Longchamp and stuff like that. These guys are writing secular sacred texts.
Vulgar Nietzscheanism. Yes, vulgar Nietzscheanism. And they never read Hegel properly. They read Hegel through Hippolyte or Kojève, only indirectly.
Kojève, yeah, right. Yeah.
That means that Deleuze's critique of Hegel is his weakest point. And the problem is that he disguises it with Spinoza worship. So, that means he goes for Spinoza without Hegel. Hegel wrote a lot about Spinoza. Hegel had a fellow called Schelling, and Schelling was a Spinozist, who was then converted into Hegelian during his own lifetime. If you read the older Schelling, you go back to the younger Schelling, you see enormous differences between the two. So Schelling was the Spinozist after Kant, who tried to go back to Spinoza and escape Kant with his Natur Philosophia. Hegel knew that was impossible. Left and said, no, Kant made a revolution. Let's go even dig even deeper and let's turn Kant against Kant. What would Kant have said about Kant critically? And that's where Hegel moved wonderfully in the early 1800s with his amazing philosophy. He's still the greatest.
I just have a question. I want to try to, if we can bring this back to the lynch mob idea a little bit.
Okay.
Are you connecting a false reading of Spinoza to let's say to the 60s America and to the postmodernist and to the present lynch mob situation? Can you like, is that what you're doing?
Yeah, because
and can you like force
okay,
that out of
call it vulgar Spinozism, and vulgar Spinozism is just pop philosophy that hasn't studied this shit. That's California New Age to you. Oh, everything is united with everything
okay,
else.
Okay, gotcha.
The world is one.
The New
and we're
Age,
all sitting
cetera,
it together. Okay. And if you only listen to each other and listen in to each other, we say we'll all be peaceful, and there'll be no antagonisms between us, and no class differences, and all we need to do is to sit
we're
and
all
talk
one,
and talk and talk like that. Then you move that into woke culture as practiced by woke people. It's the same shit. That's how woke meetings are. They sit and talk. But they add some anger to it by having an outside scapegoat they can blame. So you take California New Age or vulgar Spinozism, which is POMO, and then you put that into context when you just add some electricity to it by basically telling a 22-year-old girl that, oh, by the way, there's a 47-year-old white man outside who's a white heterosexual. He's a working-class guy and refuses to commit the revolution. Oh, I can go after him. He's my scapegoat. And off they go with their pagan scapegoat mechanisms. That's exactly what we're seeing today.
Yeah. Okay.
So in that sense, if POMO is guilty of creating woke, it's a precursor to woke, yes. Is POMO vulgar? Yes, it is, because it's essentially vulgar Spinozism. That's what it is. And that's what you get if you read Spinoza too literally and believe he speaks directly to you and you're a little Spinoza genius and you're not actually reading the amazing critiques, constructive critiques of the honored Spinoza that were written by Kant and Hegel and the other guys in the 1800s. You can't.
Changes. What is? Can you explain that? What's the step from Spinoza to Kant?
Transcendental dialectics. Yeah. Okay. So he does dialectics, and he's seriously considering the difference between my here and that thing there. That in itself divides the world between the noumenal and the phenomenal. So the unity, the sort of romantic unity of Spinoza's universe disappears. Also, Spinoza says God has a will. We have no wills. The problem is there's no will to power in Spinoza. You don't will anything, Andrew. I don't will anything. Thomas doesn't will anything. And this idea of a sort of passive subjectivity that just floats around here and there. Damasio used to be Spinozist, but he turned against Spinoza, interestingly enough, in the 2010s. That's interesting to see how he started saying it. No. The vulgar Spinozism wasn't what I meant with Spinoza being back in fashion and rereading Spinoza as a good idea if you're a cognitive scientist. Damasio is too smart for that. He turned against
There's no contingency in the universe of Spinoza. So basically there is God that knows everything, the past and the future. That means that there's no real contingency. If you would stop the universe here and you would run it again, so to speak, then you would get the same outcome. It could not be otherwise. So that's the block universe of Spinoza, and it's the universe of Einstein as well. It is.
But can you see also in the vulgarized version how attracted that is to hippies? You don't want to commit themselves to anything because it takes an effort to make a commitment.
Well, yeah, accept what is and stuff like that. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, and it all this.
And there's a lack of. I'm getting a lack of masculinity too. I'm getting a lack of energy in the
a lack of
cul-de-sac that Spinoza could become.
So Nietzsche's response to that is, of course, will to power.
Yeah.
Okay, the way to do that, take it seriously now, is to divide will to power, again, split phallus into will to intelligence and will to transcendence. Mm-hmm. And because machines will not have will to transcendence, they alone have will to intelligence, we can make the machines operate beautifully for the priests, but at the same time, we need chief to actually go out and lead and create society as a work of art. And that would require will of transcendence. This is way from Spinoza. And this is where Deleuze struggles with nomadology and everything he did in his last 10 years, in that actually, if there was a Deleuzean heritage, yeah, he could be interesting for complexity science and pretentious art or whatever. But if you're gonna make something forceful out of Deleuze, and his desire originally when he was younger was to be Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And I love Deleuze's 1960s work. I will definitely say Difference of Repetition and The Sense Book, A Theory of Sense. I would save those books from The Logic of Sense. I would save those books from What Comes Later. Deleuze and Nietzsche, the early Deleuze, I love and adore. And I think he opens up Nietzsche to an eventological interpretation of Nietzsche, which I use a lot in my work. But I don't find these sort of grandiose books like Thousand Plateaus at all as useful now as they were thought to be in the 1980s. I think actually going down the John Dewey and Deleuze Guattari path towards education for youth would be disastrous today. You'd just be hippie all over. Anthroposophical. It's theosophical. It's just hippie dumb.
Can you elaborate a bit on that? What are Dewey? You mentioned Dewey and Deleuze, and they have ideas on education. Is that correct?
And it's today when the world's falling apart and becoming chaotic, order in schools is more important than ever. Again, dialectical. If the world is chaotic, even more important to teach.
You need order. And if the world is,
if the world is ordered, you can elaborate on letting your kids be more loose and experimental. So I would say that's a perfect example of where it's not very useful to go towards Deleuze and Guattari today. And of course, even if Thousand Plateaus is a great book, an interesting, great book, it's the crap that comes afterward. I hate Hart and Negri and their Empire book and shit like that. It's the crap that comes afterward. Who call themselves neo-Spinozists, by the way. I'm not a big fan of Alain Badiou either, and certainly not of Hart and Negri. And that stuff that comes afterwards, Althusser. If you have a problem today with neo-Marxists, it's probably Althusserians you're talking about. You're talking about Spinozists who claim to be Marxists. Hmm. That's Louis Althusser. Louis Althusser is the grandfather of woke. Then comes Laclau and Mouffe along in the 1980s with the Hedge Money book. That is the Bible of the woke culture today. Judith Butler, they're all responsible for that. And it all goes back to vulgar Spinozism that avoids Kant and especially avoids Hegel. Hegel is the nasty word that should be used today aggressively. And thankfully, guys, your favorite Whitehead and Hegel are very closely aligned with one another. Read them through each other and you get them both. I mean, to me, Hegel and Whitehead are,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I have to stick to Whitehead. I can't add Hegel to the mixture. There's no time.
Okay. Well, you become the Whitehead expert.
I've been reading Hegel, but I have a rough time of it, I have to admit, reading Hegel. I am reading it, but very slowly. And
I think Adrian Johnston's doing a great job at this, and some of these ideas are obviously his as mine as much as they're mine, although I've seen it coming for years too. We've been in dialogue for years. I think Adrian is incredibly underrated because he's the only American continental philosopher, but his continental philosophy is brilliant, and he's Hegelian. But he's also defending something I don't defend, which is transcendental materialism, and I find that interesting. There's much more Marxism in Adrian Johnson's work than I would ever admit to.
Well, I was thinking
dialogue is interesting here, very interesting.
What about Heidegger here? I was thinking about why I lean towards Heidegger and Thomas leans towards Whitehead, and I was wondering, like, people who have a kind of mystical, like, I lean towards mysticism, and people who have a kind of like more scientific thing lean more towards Whitehead.
I'm a social philosopher. I can use Heidegger now and then, but the good old Nazi is not very useful for social philosophy. He's very introverted. It's very much how you experience the world, and you always end up thinking that you could experience the world Heidegger describes it, and he does that really well, but that's probably just Heidegger, and if you Heideggerians actually do experience the world that way. So, whereas Whitehead is much more neutral. He's just.
I have a question about Heidegger. So Heidegger is basically phenomenology, right? He describes what it is like to be human in a very unusual way, so you can kind of get a new perspective on it. But to what extent does he actually have a metaphysics? Because Whitehead is
He's against metaphysics. I mean, isn't he trying to destroy metaphysics on some level?
And they pointed out that, Heidegger has a metaphysics, and I was got a bit unsure about
that. Heidegger said he didn't have a metaphysics and he hated it, but he used the word metaphysics in the very original sense. Right. It was a certain history that he was opposed to. He was very grandiose when he was young and he wanted to kill it. I'm opposite to Deleuze. I actually think Sign and Sight is a bit overrated. I read it when I was young and I was inspired by it. But since I didn't want to become a pretentious poet, it wasn't really for me. So, but I love the old Heidegger. And I know Thomas got a start of the Nietzsche books that he wrote in the 1960s. I think the older Heidegger is way more interesting. And he sometimes nails things beautifully. I mean, he's an Oscar Wilde an Oscar Wilde without
great
the sense
to read
of
him. He's fun to read, I think.
It is fun to read.
Well, that's the only reason, I read him.
But you cannot create a Heideggerian system to describe the internet age or the network society. Mm. It's useless. I can use Heidegger to discover that Das Mann is the origin of the adject, because that's actually lacking in Girard's theory, because he didn't look into the precursors. Fine, Girard didn't have to. Now, the theory becomes more complete, and I can also make both an exodology and inverted exodology by discovering that the adject must then have a precursor to the savior. So where's the origin of the savior? Is it Christ in the cradle? No, but Christ in the cradle was probably symbolically very important to declare that a precursor would come there. It could be John the Baptist or somebody else the precursor to. But the precursor is the guy who steps up against the lynch mob. So John the Baptist's head on the plate is clearly a precursor to the Messiah in Christian mythology. So that's why the hyperject is where I'm going next in my studies to conclude the exodology. And then the priest, if you're the first Sashant like Moses, you don't go into the promised land. Almost symbolically, you switch from first to second Sashant, but dying before you enter the promised land. But you do send the chieftain into the promised land, because he's the physical guy actually leads them into the promised land. Because for you, the journey was the only thing that was important. And that's typical for Sashants. For the Sashant, his only interest is to complete his work. And his work is to stop the lynch mob and make people realize that this is a fantastic golden opportunity in history to do exactly the opposite thing of lynch mobbing, which is to leave the lynch mob, get out of it, and walk in the opposite direction into the promised land and be heroic.
Right.
And so that's why I'm interested in phallic, because the phallic is ultimately what is lacking today, not even religion, but phallic religion itself is lacking. And that's where I want to work. That's where we're completing our trilogy with the exodology. First synthesis,
We have the false Dionysian, right?
We have that still, the false Dionysian and the authentic Dionysian.
It's the kick that you get from joining the mob, right? So that's this Dionysian feeling, that's this, the frenzy of the kill. Now you get that via Facebook, right? I mean, look, I wrote this first, I got him. So that's this Dionysian feeling, but it's of course the fake Dionysian, right? This is kind of like a very bleak and unrewarding form of the Dionysian.
Describe the real Dionysian then, the good Dionysian. That's this ecstatic sort of communitas where you get together.
Burning Man.
Burning Man, right.
It's Burning Man. It is. It is paradigmatically heroic as a collective effort. So it is Dionysian is crowd, but this is crowd rather than mob. And it's crowd in the sense that it takes on the heroic. Why Burning Man works is because you have to make an effort for yourself to go there. You have to make an effort to survive. It's called radical self-expression, radical self-reliance. If the principle of radical self-reliance wasn't there, Burning Man would be another lynch mob probably and then fail. But it stays and goes on year after year after year. And has 200 copycats around the world. Again, mimicking works here as well. And these are authentically Dionysian. So these are the festivals and the carnivals of religion where you celebrate.
Carnival
is authentic Dionysian, exactly.
Yeah, gotcha, carnival.
Yeah. But the Exodus would be Apollonian, wouldn't it? It requires organization, commitment, theory. It requires priest. It requires chieftain. It requires a hell of an effort. That's exactly why it's small elite to actually perform the Exodus.
You don't live in the Dionysian. This is an event. The Dionysian should always be like limited in time. Otherwise, it kills you. Basically, I think that
festival days, like, you know,
burned up because he lived constantly in the Dionysian. In the end, he actually realized that he did it because he started. We started writing the crucified, right? He identified actually in the end with Jesus.
which he said, "I am the crucified," didn't he?
Christ has killed me. So that's a very interesting turn he took at the end of his life. Girard also writes about that. It's very fascinating. These two guys, you know, Girard and Nietzsche, we should have had them in the same room and let them have a discussion.
Oh, God. And Whitehead.
I don't know. Whitehead would just drink tea.
The ultimate nerd. The ultimate
he's
nerd.
He's too much of a nerd. I was thinking that, too.
Whitehead was.
I think Girard's a bit of a nerd, too. Nietzsche doesn't belong on any other planet except his own.
I would have loved Hegel because he was actually incredibly successful and flamboyant and fun during his own lifetime. He became a multimillionaire in Germany.
Why don't we train AI from Hegel manuscripts,
yes,
manuscripts, and then we let them talk to each other?
Yeah, they resurrected from the dead.
Yeah, we have to resurrect all of these souls and put them on the AI machine.
God.
We let them talk to each other, just like, you know, Microsoft did that with some kind of bot that was trained from a lot of example texts and stuff like that, right? So that might actually work.
Yeah. And we could resurrect Carl Schmitt, see whether he'd be Nazi or not.
Yeah. You know, we throw Heidegger in there and stuff like that.
We probably have to do like a Futurama. We have to lock their heads up in a cabin or somewhere. They won't get bodies. So they just uploaded.
And we resurrect 200 philosophers and we just let them discuss for a million years, which we can probably execute in 1 hour.
I have to discuss this with Simon Critchley and finally get him back to work on a follow-up to his amazing book, Dead Philosophers. Resurrected Philosophers is next. That'd be a great idea.
Well, there's the Monty Python skit with all the philosophers playing football. Have you seen that one?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Classic. Yeah.
But well, you can study Hegel or Whitehead the rest of your life, and they're richly rewarding when you do it. And I love both guys to bits. But I would insist that this is philosophy, and the relationalism of Whitehead looks more and more like the pandialecticism of Hegel to me, the more I read them.
Oh yeah, but it's true. Bradley, right? So Whitehead was, he claimed he never read Hegel, but he read Bradley. And Bradley was the British interpreter of Hegel. And so that's the connection between Whitehead and Hegel.
And so again, that is a very uncorrupted version, because the problem with Hegelianism in Europe was that it was either through Kojève or Hippolyte in France. The French took over Hegel in the 1940s. Obviously, Germany was in ruins. So we only got these different Hippolyte and Kojève readings. It wasn't until Lacan that we finally got a proper Hegelian reading that he opened up to. And that's exactly why Hegelians like me and Johnston and Slavoj Žižek and Alenka Sopančić are all coming out of the Lacanian school, and we're Hegelians. That makes perfect sense. This is a Hegelian reading that's way closer to Nietzsche and Whitehead as it should have been all along.
But, you know, Hegel had a theory of desire that was very close to Girard's, but his was a dyad instead of a triad. So you want to be desired by somebody else, while the desire of Girard is a triad, right?
Mm. There's always a third wheel in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But would Hegel need a third wheel since he was dialectical anyway in anything?
I think so. Yeah. I think that this is a he had a very important insight, Hegel, but Girard kind of he perfected it. Yeah.
Great. I'll look into that. Oh, one more thing before we finish tonight. The martyrdom thing. So is martyrdom universal, or is it exclusively for only some religions where it pays off? And who's the martyr really? Because the martyr can be both really nasty and incredibly wonderful and respected human being.
I think the Romans didn't have this. I think this is a Christian thing and an Abrahamic thing.
Abrahamic thing.
I think so.
It feels like an Abrahamic thing to me, yeah.
It's like you have to go through a torture chamber and stay with your God, even if you're being tortured. Otherwise, you're not a martyr. Then the Zoroastrians don't have martyrdom either. They don't have a word for it.
There's not much martyrdom in Buddhist texts. You know, there's it's kind of an unclean. There's something about it that is.
If somebody puts a knife against my throat and threatens to kill me if I don't declare myself to be non-Zoroastrian, I can say that I'm a non-Zoroastrian. And all Zoroastrians, no Bedouins would accuse me of anything because I'm being threatened with my life.
The problem is, I guess, the worship of death, right? That's what.
No.
It's
a worship of a certain principle that is incredibly strong and attractive, though. I have to admit that. Obviously, martyrdom worked for Christianity. It made it popular. And it created a whole pantheon of saints, which is incredibly useful. You got all the lesser gods of Catholicism for the next 2,000 years of martyrdom, because martyrs, obviously the vast majority of saints are martyrs one way or the other. So it was very useful for Christianity. Whereas Zoroastrianism dragged along a folk religion for as long as it lasted, you know, with the Anahita worship and things like that, which made Zoroastrianism better for inclusion, meaning you're going to have a pluralistic society, power sharing, and you're going to have different levels. Like you can have an elite religion here and you can have a folk religion here, which is just like India operates. It's just Brahmanism and Hinduism. And that became like Zurvanism and folk Zoroastrianism. But the problem with that is that you do not actively replace the pantheon of the lesser gods, which Christianity did, and instead put the martyrs in there and found them very useful. Church paintings and everything.
Well, also, I think that the martyrs, rich religion, like if you read the lives of the saints, the martyrs are always, they're always morally pure. They always have this, there's everything about them is perfect. There's this kind of idealization.
No.
Compared to like the, when I read about
Andrew, there are no such people
Tibetan
in Christianity.
Saints, then they're always, they used to be like, you know, murderers and killers and
Christianity is the same. Starting with Saint Paul. Mm-hmm. Paul persecuted the Jews and killed them and went after them, and then on the road to Damascus he became Saint Paul. No, Christianity is full
of
people.
That's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's full of people who transcended themselves by staying true with their faith even through death and torture. The martyrdom is precisely the human who goes beyond being human but stays human in the process. Christians would be adamant that martyrs are, nobody's perfect. Everybody's a sinner in Christianity.
Everybody's a sinner in Christianity.
Yeah. Everybody's a sinner. They're no perfect. No, they're not role models to look up to because of their lives. The role models to look up to because the principle stands on the faith itself.
Okay.
But it does seem to be a copying of Jesus Christ, right? So let's do it again. And it's kind of ignoring the fact, you know, the gospel is the good news. It's kind of like, you know, Jesus did it for you. He did it once and for all, showed the victimage mechanism. It's done. It's written down. He's done it for you.
So it's a new kind of mimesis. It's a new kind of imitation that's taking over, like a kind of a
certain, I mean, it is a certain, wanting to be the savior yourself as well, right?
There could certainly be those cases, yeah. That's why I'm saying that some of the martyrs were obviously narcissistic assholes. And some of the martyrs were probably fantastic people to look up to. And it's probably the same with the saints in that case.
And in Islam also.
Again, we can use the corpses for whatever we'd like. And Christianity has done so very creatively over the past 2,000 years. Probably Mother Teresa wasn't a very nice person at all. But, you know, at the end of the day, her corpse could be used for good purposes for the church. And they gladly did so. So there's a certain cynicism in the usage of corpses after they're dead, because we have the liberty to do whatever we like with them. They're dead after all, right? We do what we want with the heritages. So which is fine. I think Thomas's critique of martyrs being narcissistic copycats of Christ on the cross in those cases where it's true is a classic Protestant critique of Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. It makes sense. It just made Catholicism so much richer religion.
In Islam, they seem to love martyrs in Islam as well too, don't they? Isn't that something that you would want to be a martyr? Like you would just train to be a martyr, and that would be you would have that as a goal, right?
Yeah, but they don't have the sainthood that you have in Catholicism. That you're more or less guaranteed if you're a martyr and somebody saw you die, right? Mm.
You go to paradise. You're living for the afterworld.
I'd be careful to have, that's exactly a martyrdom. I might even leave it out of the book. It's a very, very, very interesting topic. And it probably fascinates because Zoroastrianism doesn't think much of it. It certainly is a huge part of Islam. And since Islam has mimicked Zoroastrianism to a large extent, they got it from Gnosticism or something like that. It's something Gnostic about martyrdom. And
yeah.
But I'm not an expert in Islamic martyrs at all. I certainly haven't figured out the relationship between the Gnostic and the martyr. It's probably a nasty one.
You have to explain martyrdom with respect to triangular desire. So you have to kind of take a look at, for example, things like sadomasochism, because you will probably find the explanation there. So Girard has some very interesting theories and that basically explains why do people, for example, adopt sadomasochistic relationships. and or for example, the relationships of a cult follower and a guru. So these are basically elementary outcomes of triangular desire.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's getting closer. I think it's.
And there's a nasty side to that whole thing with sort of masochistic narcissism leading up to martyrdom, certainly. But I'm sure the people who were just scapegoated and happened to be nice people and who refused to, you know, at the end of the day, if you're being tortured and you go through suffering, you're probably going to die. And they tell you to resign from your faith. And the guys standing in front of you are just ugly idiots. It's just like, why would you give it to them? They're going to kill you anyway. You might as well stay with the faith. That's probably how most martyrdoms actually occurred. You know, so, but it's an interesting...
The stories are always told in a heroic way, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Martyrology is a topic open to our students to explore if they like to. I think I'm fine with starting the Sociant and the Resurrection of the Phallus for the new book. And then off I go. I'm turning 60 next year. I'm ready for a commentary with cigars and cognac. And so John Sedekis says the same thing. We'll see what happens next. But we're going to write a fucking Bible at least first. Process an event. We're working on it. And I'm thrilled of having these discussions with you guys and credit you for your inputs.
So Gerard and Whitehead, that's a great combination. That should be...
And Hegel.
And Nietzsche.
And Hegel.
Okay, Hegel. Oh, yeah. Whitehead is already in there, so who needs Hegel? But, you know,
yeah.
Nietzsche, Whitehead, Gerard. That's kind of like the triad I would like to see in a book. No.
Yeah, we got our own pantheon there.
Don't forget Lagchimpa. But anyway... And
we'll read Derrida, right? I mean, look,
we need some lesser gods too, guys, okay?